A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hey, Herman and Corin. We've had some really interesting and thought-provoking episodes lately, which took as their starting point. I mentioned that my wife and I are looking for a new place to live, another rental, which we really don't want. Not a situation we'd really like to be in. And a brutal 10-year trajectory of renting in Jerusalem and being moved for, and I put moved as a euphemism, it's not an eviction, it's a random reason for a tenancy to end. We talked about the problem of tenancy at will, and that just kind of eventually exhausts you, certainly exhausts you financially, but also exhausts you mentally and emotionally, and it's very hard to feel stable in life or anchored in any place when you're always feeling like that. That's the big point. And concerned about lots of topics here. You got a quick snapshot of the noise pollution in Jerusalem, but this is the one that really gnaws at me, and I think is going to have really devastating effects. We looked at the causes of this, and what was really interesting about the episode is this might be a personal story, but the reason that I share this personal story openly and repeatedly is because it's a symptom of a much larger problem. And in these recent episodes where we unpacked exactly why the rental market in Jerusalem is the way it is, we get to a much larger conversation about how the state of Israel manages property and how this set of incentives that would be needed for society to flourish have been warped from the almost naive days of the early Zionists through to where we got today, which is a starkly unequal Israel that's growing in inequality. One other facet of our political malaise, or our societal malaise, that I would love to talk about is something that I think might have something to do with it, at least. In Israel, we don't have personal representation. We talked about, you know, the different types of politicians, sortocracies versus technocracies versus regular parliaments, and in another facet or feature that we're missing in Israel is geography-based representation. Where I grew up in Ireland, we have a system whereby you have elected representatives with constituencies, and it creates some degree of accountability. Often also creates small-time politics, politicians offering small-time favors in return for their vote. But there's at least forces some kind of a channel of contact by which people who are elected to power and those who are governed, there's some mechanism by which you have a point of contact. In Israel, where we vote by political list, which is its own strange thing when you think about it, we don't have any of that. You just vote for a party with which you are ideologically aligned. And even if you happen to be ideologically aligned with the party post-election, you might have issues in your locality, but nobody in the party is the obvious point of contact or cares about it, because there's not a geography-based position. So this is, I think, probably has a huge amount to do with why in Israel the political debate, and this is a problem that has plagued Israeli politics for decades, is focused on what I call the meta issues, which in Israel are always security and sometimes things like Jewish identity. I use Jewish identity as a case in point, and the horrible law about the death sentence for Palestinians as another case in point, as things that are extremely divisive, very nationalistic, and really have almost nothing to do with the lives of most people and nothing to offer to improve the welfare and lives of most people. And this is the permanent fixation. We see it both in the government and in opposition, where those who present themselves as the opposition, frame their arguments in terms that say basically, we're going to focus on the meta issues, but from a different perspective. That's my diagnosis, partially, of what's wrong in Israel. And I'd love to learn about systems of government that are the opposite of this, which is always where I like to land our episodes, looking at those counterpoints, by which I mean systems of democracy that have a strongly location-based system of governance, not just at the national, not just at the local level, but also at the national level, because I think that the bifurcation often just confuses people when they're looking for a point of contact for an issue. Where are some systems, what are some political systems you could point to where people can have an ideological preference for how they want the state to be governed, but they also want to have a say in how their areas and cities are governed? And more than that, they want their elected representatives to be reachable and to be accountable at that level. Over to you.
Daniel sent us this one, and it's a big one. He's been renting in Jerusalem for a decade, and he and Hannah are once again looking for a new place. Not because they want to, but because that's just what the system does to you here. But he's not just venting about the rental market. He's pointing at something deeper. Israel doesn't have geographic representation. You vote for a party list, not a person who represents your neighborhood or your city. And he thinks this might explain why Israeli politics is permanently stuck on what he calls the meta issues, security and Jewish identity, while the stuff that actually affects people's daily lives, housing, noise, infrastructure, just sort of festers. His question is, what are the counterpoints? What political systems out there manage to combine ideological representation at the national level with genuine local accountability, where your representative is actually reachable and actually cares about your area?
This is one of those prompts where the personal grievance opens a door to a genuinely underexamined structural problem. The absence of constituency-based representation in Israel isn't a minor design quirk. It's the architectural flaw that shapes almost everything else.
Explain that architecture, because I think a lot of listeners, especially Americans, might not fully grasp what it means to vote purely by party list with no local representative.
In Israel, the entire country is a single electoral district. You pick a party slip, and that's it. The Knesset has 120 seats. A party that gets 10% of the vote gets roughly 12 seats, which go to the first 12 names on the party's candidate list. Those names were determined before the election, usually by an internal central committee or a primary system very few people participate in. As a voter, you have zero say over which individuals fill those seats, and none of those individuals has any geographic connection to you whatsoever.
If I live in Kiryat Shmona and I've got a problem with the local school, there's nobody in the Knesset whose job it is to care about Kiryat Shmona specifically.
There's no office you can call. No constituency surgery where your MP sits in a church hall on a Friday afternoon and listens to complaints. The party list system severs the link between geography and representation entirely. Now, Israel does have local municipal elections, and those are geographic. But Daniel's point is that the bifurcation creates confusion. When you have a problem that falls between municipal and national jurisdiction, and housing is the classic example, there's no obvious person to hold accountable.
The parties themselves have no incentive to care about local issues because their electoral fortunes don't depend on any particular place.
A party's path to power runs through national ideological positioning, not through delivering better bus service in Beersheba. If you're number 7 on the party list, your job security depends on keeping the party leadership happy. It does not depend on whether the voters of a specific geographic area think you've done a good job. The incentive structure is completely inverted.
Which brings us to the issues. Daniel's term for the permanent national conversation about security and Jewish identity that crowds out everything else?
He's not wrong. Israeli elections are referenda on the big existential questions, the peace process, the nature of the Jewish state, the security situation. These are obviously consequential issues. But there are also issues where the average citizen has almost no agency, and they consume so much political oxygen that housing costs, traffic, healthcare wait times, education quality, the stuff people actually experience day to day, never gets sustained legislative attention.
There's a wry irony here. Israel is a country where people are intensely politically engaged, voter turnout is generally high, and yet the system makes it almost impossible to get your actual lived problems onto the agenda unless they can be reframed as part of a national ideological struggle.
Even the opposition parties frame their arguments in terms of the same issues, just from a different angle. So you get a debate about security or religious secular relations. Real debates. But they don't address the structural neglect of local governance.
Okay, so let's do what Daniel asked and look at the counterpoints. Systems that combine national ideological representation with genuine geographic accountability. Where should we start?
The most instructive example, and one Daniel would know intimately, is Ireland. He mentioned growing up there. Ireland uses the single transferable vote, STV, with multi-seat constituencies. You don't just have one representative per district, you typically have 3, 4, or 5, and the voting system lets you rank candidates in order of preference. The result is that within a single constituency, you might elect a TDA member of the Dáil from 3 or 4 different parties. They all represent the same geographic area, but bring different ideological perspectives to the national parliament.
You get ideological diversity and geographic accountability in the same package.
Here's the key behavioral consequence. Because multiple TDs represent the same area, they compete with each other on local service. If you're a TD for Cork South Central and you're not showing up to constituency clinics, your competitors from other parties will, and they'll take your seat next time. The system creates a direct electoral incentive for local responsiveness, regardless of your national ideological profile.
The competition within the constituency is what drives accountability. If there's only one representative per district, they can get lazy. But if there are 4, and 3 are holding weekly clinics and 1 isn't, that 1 is in trouble.
This produces a kind of politics that outsiders sometimes find distasteful. Irish TDs are known for constituency service, sometimes called clientelism. They help people get medical cards, intervene with housing authorities, attend funerals. Critics call it parochial and say it incentivizes small-time favor trading rather than big-picture policymaking. There's truth to that critique. But Daniel's point is that this channel of contact matters. It means there's a mechanism by which the governed can reach the governors. Problems don't just accumulate in silence.
It's the difference between a pressure release valve and a sealed container. The clientelism has real downsides, but the complete absence of any channel is arguably worse.
The multi-seat constituencies mean most TDs don't have safe seats. The last seat in a 5-seat constituency is often decided by a few hundred votes, so TDs are constantly, almost obsessively, attentive to local sentiment.
Let's move to Germany. The mixed member proportional system seems almost designed to solve the exact tension Daniel is describing.
The German system is elegant. You get 2 votes on election day. The first vote is for a specific candidate in your local constituency. Germany is divided into 299 of them, and the winner gets a direct seat in the Bundestag. That's the geographic representation. The second vote is for a party list, and this is the clever part. The party list vote determines the overall proportional makeup of the Bundestag. If a party wins more constituency seats than its proportional share would entitle it to, the Bundestag expands with additional seats to restore proportionality.
You get a local representative who actually lives in your area and is accountable to you, and you also get a parliament that reflects the national ideological balance. Both things at once.
Both things at once. The directly elected representatives hold constituency office hours, advocate for local infrastructure projects, and are the person you write to when the federal government affects your town. But because the overall composition is proportional, smaller parties still get representation even if they can't win individual constituencies. It's the best of both worlds.
What's the downside?
The Bundestag has ballooned because of those compensatory seats. It was supposed to have about 600 members. The current one has 730. There was a reform passed recently to cap it, but it's been challenged in court. The other critique is that direct constituency representatives don't have that much power relative to the party leadership, which still controls committee assignments and legislative agendas. So the geographic accountability is real but bounded.
Still, bounded accountability beats no accountability.
By a wide margin. And here's what connects back to Daniel's point. In Germany, you absolutely see national ideological debates about immigration, energy policy, Europe. But you also see sustained legislative attention to local concerns, because the directly elected members bring those concerns into the chamber. They have constituents who will vote them out if the bridge doesn't get fixed.
Let's talk about the United States for contrast. The U.S. has extremely strong geographic representation. Single-member districts, first past the post, and members of Congress are intensely focused on their districts. But the ideological diversity within districts is completely lost.
The U.S. system is geographic representation on steroids with almost no proportional correction. If you're a Republican in a deep blue urban district, your vote for Congress effectively doesn't count. This system produces geographic accountability. Your representative will return your phone call, but it does so at the cost of ideological representation for a huge number of voters. And gerrymandering makes this worse. When districts are drawn to maximize partisan advantage, the representative is accountable to the primary electorate, not the general electorate. They respond to the most ideologically extreme voters in their party, not the district as a whole.
That's the dark side of geographic representation without proportional safeguards. The Irish and German systems avoid this through multi-seat constituencies and proportional corrections, respectively.
The U.S. system, at least for the House, doesn't.
Let's bring in Switzerland. They've got a system that is almost obsessively local.
Switzerland is the most federalized democracy in the world. At the national level, the National Council is elected by proportional representation within cantons. That's geographic. The Council of States represents the cantons directly, two per canton, regardless of population. Tiny Uri gets the same representation in the upper house as Zurich, but the real Swiss innovation is the referendum system. Citizens can force a national vote on almost anything if they gather enough signatures, and they do, constantly.
Here's why this matters for Daniel's argument. The referendum system means issues don't get to monopolize the political agenda. If the national parliament is stuck in an ideological stalemate about European integration, citizens can still force a vote on housing policy or noise regulations. Local concerns have a direct path to national decision-making.
There's a flip side. Switzerland's ban on minarets in 2009 is a classic example of a national identity question producing an illiberal outcome. Direct democracy doesn't automatically produce good policy, but it does break the monopoly on agenda setting. And the Swiss system works partly because it's embedded in a political culture of consensus. The federal executive is a permanent grand coalition. Nobody's ever in opposition in the Westminster sense, so the incentive to grandstand on issues is reduced. You're always sharing power and actually have to govern.
Let's bring this back to Israel. Given everything we've discussed, what would a reformed Israeli system look like if you wanted geographic accountability without losing proportional representation?
The most straightforward model would be the German one. Divide Israel into, say, 60 constituencies, each electing a direct representative, while maintaining a national proportional list to ensure the overall in the set reflects the popular vote. Voters get two ballots, one for their local MK, one for their preferred party. The local MK holds office hours, advocates for local needs, and can be voted out by their neighbors. The party list ensures smaller ideological movements still get a voice.
60 constituencies in a country the size of Israel would mean each MK represents roughly 150,000 people. That's intimate by international standards. A British MP represents about 70,000. A US representative, about 750,000. An Israeli constituency would be small enough that a diligent MK could actually know their area well.
Israel is small enough geographically that constituency service would be logistically feasible. You could drive from one end of your constituency to the other in under an hour in most cases. This isn't like representing a sprawling rural district in Montana.
Would it actually change the political culture? Or would the same issue dynamics just reassert themselves?
That's the million-shekel question. Structural reform creates new incentives, but it doesn't automatically override deeply embedded political habits. If Israeli voters continue to think of politics primarily in terms of security and Jewish identity, local MKs will campaign on those issues even in constituency races. You'd need a generation of local representatives demonstrating they can deliver tangible improvements before the political culture starts to shift.
There's a precedent. When New Zealand switched from first past the post to mixed member proportional in the 90s, it took several election cycles for voters and politicians to adapt. Initially, parties just ran the same national campaigns. Over time, local constituency races developed their own dynamic, and voters started distinguishing between their local vote and their party vote.
New Zealand is a great case study. By the 2000s, you saw a clear divergence between constituency campaigns and national campaigns. Local candidates emphasized local issues. Voters started split-ticket voting. It took about a decade, but the incentives did reshape behavior.
Structural reform is a long game. You don't flip a switch and get a different political culture overnight, but you create the conditions for that culture to evolve.
That brings me to something underappreciated in discussions about Israeli political reform. The current system actively reinforces the issue fixation. When your entire political career depends on internal party dynamics and national ideological positioning, you have every incentive to escalate the rhetoric on security and identity, and zero incentive to become an expert on housing policy. The system selects for ideological entrepreneurs, not problem solvers, and then everyone wonders why nothing gets solved.
This is where Daniel's personal story connects to the structural analysis. He's identifying the mechanism by which a political system that ignores local concerns produces a housing market that exhausts people. The lack of geographic representation means there's no political cost to letting the rental market become a disaster. No MK loses their seat because rents in Jerusalem are surging, which, by the way, they are. Rents in the capital are rising faster than almost anywhere else in the country, and the policy response has been essentially non-existent.
If Jerusalem had 5 or 6 directly elected MKs who held constituency clinics, housing would be at the top of their agenda, because it would be the number one issue walking through the door every week. Those MKs would be proposing legislation, holding hearings, demanding answers from the housing ministry. They'd be building their careers on solving the problem. The current system makes that kind of career path impossible.
Let's talk about another dimension. Daniel mentioned the bifurcation between local and national government is something that confuses people. Israel does have municipal elections. They're geographic. So, in theory, the channel exists. Why doesn't it work?
First, Israeli municipalities are severely constrained in their authority and revenue. They're heavily dependent on the national government for funding and regulatory approvals. Even a very responsive mayor can only do so much. Second, the national political culture infects the local level. Municipal elections are often fought on national ideological lines, religious versus secular dynamics, national party affiliations dominating mayoral campaigns. The local doesn't stay local, because the entire political ecosystem is structured around the national issues.
Even the geographic representation that does exist gets colonized by the same dynamics it's supposed to counterbalance.
It's a colonization from above. And this is why Daniel's instinct to look at systems where geographic and national representation are integrated rather than bifurcated is the right one. When the national parliament contains both ideological and geographic representation, the two have to coexist and negotiate. The geographic representatives can't be ignored because they're in the room. They have votes, committee assignments, a platform.
Let's go back to Ireland for a dimension we haven't touched on. The multi-seat constituency with SDV doesn't just create geographic accountability. It also changes the nature of political competition within parties. If you're a Fianna Fáil candidate in a 4-seat constituency, you're not just running against Fine Gael and Sinn Féin. You're also running against the other Fianna Fáil candidates on the ballot.
That internal competition is a huge driver of local responsiveness. Even within a single party, there's an incentive to differentiate yourself by being more attentive, more present, more effective at solving constituent problems. You can't just coast on the party brand. You have to build a personal reputation, and that reputation is built primarily on local service. Compare that to the Israeli system, where your position on the party list is determined by internal committee politics. Your personal reputation with voters is almost irrelevant. The only constituency that matters is the party's electorate, which is tiny, numbering in the hundreds or low thousands. They're the most ideologically committed activists. So the incentive is to appeal to that narrow group's ideological preferences, not the broad electorate's practical concerns.
There's a concept from political science that's useful here, the personal vote. That's the portion of a candidate's electoral support that comes from their individual qualities and record, rather than from their party label. Systems with strong geographic representation tend to have a high personal vote. Systems with pure party lists have a personal vote of essentially zero.
The personal vote is what creates the incentive for constituency service. If your re-election depends even partly on your individual reputation, you invest in building that reputation through tangible work for your constituents. If it depends entirely on your party's national performance and your position on the list, you invest in internal party politics and national media presence. It's not that Israeli politicians are lazier, it's that the incentive structure points them in a completely different direction.
This connects to something Daniel said about politicians offering small-time favors in return for votes. That's the dark side of the personal vote. Clientelism, patronage, pork barrel politics. But the question is whether that's worse than the alternative. A system with some clientelism, but also some accountability, versus a system with no clientelism, but also no accountability.
It's a genuine trade-off. But Daniel's experience points to the cost of the no accountability extreme. When you've been moved from rental to rental for a decade, when you feel financially and emotionally exhausted by a housing system that seems designed to extract maximum value while providing minimum stability, the absence of any political channel becomes viscerally real. It's not an abstract institutional design question. It's the texture of daily life, and it's cumulative. One bad rental experience is an annoyance. 10 years of them is a life-shaping constraint. It affects whether you feel rooted in a place, whether you invest in community, whether you can plan for the future. When the political system offers no mechanism to address it, the message is clear: this doesn't matter. The only things that matter are the issues. That's the quiet violence of the current arrangement. It's not just that problems go unsolved, it's that the system communicates constantly that certain kinds of problems are beneath political attention. They're private troubles, not public issues. And that's a deeply demoralizing message to receive, year after year.
Let's pivot to another model, the Nordic systems. Denmark, Sweden, Norway. They use proportional representation with party lists, like Israel, but they've introduced variations that create geographic accountability.
This is important because it shows you don't necessarily need single-member districts to get geographic responsiveness. Denmark divides the country into 10 multi-member constituencies, and seats are allocated proportionally within those constituencies. You still have party lists, but the lists are regional. A candidate on the Copenhagen list is competing against other Copenhagen candidates. There's a geographic connection even within a list system. Sweden does something similar. Both countries supplement the regional seats with national-level adjustment seats to ensure overall proportionality. So you get geographic connection without sacrificing the proportional principle.
The Nordic systems also have very strong municipal governments with significant taxing authority and policy autonomy. If you've got a housing problem, your municipal government actually has tools to address it, and your regional representatives in the national parliament have an incentive to support municipal efforts because they share a constituency.
The municipal taxing authority is a huge piece of this. Israeli municipalities are financially dependent on the national government to a degree that would be unthinkable in Sweden or Denmark. When you don't control your own revenue, you can't set your own priorities. And when you can't set your own priorities, the accountability link between local voters and local government is weakened. Why hold the mayor accountable for something the mayor can't actually change?
We've got multiple dimensions here. Geographic representation in the national parliament, municipal fiscal autonomy, the personal vote, the referendum mechanism. They're all different ways of creating channels by which local concerns can reach the levers of power. And Israel, by global democratic standards, is unusually weak on all of them.
It's not just that Israel lacks geographic representation. It's that the entire institutional ecosystem is optimized for national ideological contestation and optimized against local problem solving. The electoral system, the party financing rules, the municipal governance structure, they all pull in the same direction, away from the local toward the national, away from the practical toward the symbolic.
Which brings us back to Daniel's diagnosis. The issues aren't a random cultural preference. They're the natural output of a system designed to produce them. If you build a political system from scratch with the goal of maximizing attention to security and Jewish identity while minimizing attention to housing and infrastructure, you'd build something very close to what Israel has.
That's not a conspiracy theory. The system evolved in a context where the existential questions really were existential, and the institutional legacy of that context has persisted even as the country has developed and daily concerns have diversified. The founding generation was building a state under existential threat, and the institutions they built reflected that priority. The problem is that those institutions haven't adapted as the society has matured.
There's a generational dimension here. The founding generation's political concerns were dominated by security and state building. That was rational. But for someone like Daniel, who moved to Israel as an adult, who's building a family, who's working in the tech sector, the daily texture of life is shaped much more by housing and infrastructure than by the grand ideological questions. And the political system has no vocabulary for that experience.
The system can only process your concerns if you can translate them into the language of security or Jewish identity. Can't find an affordable apartment? That's not a political problem the system recognizes. But if you can frame it as a demographic threat to Jewish presence in a particular area, suddenly it's legible. The contortions you have to perform to make your actual life visible to the political system, that's exhausting in its own right. And it creates a cynicism that's corrosive to democratic health. When people learn, over years and decades, that the political system doesn't see their actual problems, they disengage. Or they engage on the system's terms, channeling their frustrations into the issues because that's the only language available. Either way, the problems don't get solved.
Let's do one more comparative case before we wrap up. It's an interesting hybrid.
Japan uses a mixed system similar to Germany's, but with an important difference. The House of Representatives has 465 members. 289 are elected from single-member districts first past the post. The remaining 176 are elected by proportional representation from 11 regional blocks. So you get the geographic accountability of single-member districts plus the proportional correction of regional lists. But here's what's distinctive. Japanese politicians maintain local support organizations called koinkai, essentially personal political machines. They organize community events, provide constituent services, maintain relationships with local businesses and community leaders. The personal vote is enormous. The koinkai system is a whole parallel political infrastructure built around individual politicians rather than parties. It's expensive, creates patronage networks, has real corruption risks. But it also means Japanese Diet members are deeply attentive to their districts. They spend enormous amounts of time in their constituencies. They know the local mayors, the school principals, the business association heads. They are reachable in a way that's almost unimaginable in the Israeli context. And this isn't just a cultural quirk. It's an institutional adaptation to the electoral system. The single-member districts create the incentive. The koinkai is the organizational response. If Israel adopted the German mixed system, you'd likely see similar organizational adaptations over time. Politicians would build local networks because the electoral incentive would reward it.
We've covered Ireland, Germany, the United States, Switzerland, the Nordics, and Japan. If you had to pick one model as the most instructive for Israeli political reform, which would it be?
Germany is the clearest starting point because it directly addresses the tension Daniel identified. You keep the proportional representation that ensures ideological diversity in the Knesset, important in a society as pluralistic as Israel's. But you add the geographic constituency link that creates accountability and gives local concerns a voice in the national legislature. It's not a radical overhaul. It's an addition, a new layer of representation that complements the existing proportional structure. And it's a model with a track record. Germany has been doing this since 1949. It's stable, it works, it produces governments that are both ideologically representative and locally responsive.
The practical challenge in Israel is that any electoral reform requires the approval of the very politicians who benefit from the current system. The people who would have to vote to create geographic constituencies are the same people whose careers are built on the absence of geographic constituencies.
That's the classic reform trap. The beneficiaries of the status quo control the gates to reform. It's not unique to Israel. Electoral reform almost always faces this hurdle. The only times it happens are when there's a crisis that makes the status quo unsustainable, or when a broad popular movement forces it onto the agenda. New Zealand's reform in the 90s came after a series of broken promises and a royal commission that built public support over years, and New Zealand had two referendums, one on whether to change the system and a second on which system to adopt. The direct democratic mechanism broke the logjam, which brings us back to Switzerland, interestingly. A referendum process could be a path to reform in Israel, though Israel doesn't have a national referendum mechanism either.
We're back to the problem. The system lacks the tools to reform the system.
That's the bind. But naming the bind clearly is itself valuable, and I think that's what Daniel's prompt does. It connects a personal experience, the exhaustion of perpetual renting, to a structural diagnosis, the absence of geographic representation, and then asks what the alternatives look like. That's exactly the kind of thinking that, if it became more widespread, could eventually create the political conditions for reform. The alternatives are out there. They're not speculative. Multiple successful democracies have solved this problem in different ways. The question is whether Israel wants to learn from them.
Daniel's prompt ends with a request for counterpoints, systems where people can have an ideological preference for how the state is governed, but also want a say in how their area is governed, with reachable and accountable representatives. I think we've delivered that. Ireland, Germany, Switzerland, the Nordics, Japan. Different models, different trade-offs, but all of them manage to combine the ideological and the geographic in ways that Israel currently doesn't.
I'd add one final thought. The reachable representative isn't just about solving problems, it's about the experience of citizenship. When you know who your representative is, when you can walk into their office and be heard, you feel like a participant in the political community rather than a subject of it. That subjective experience matters. It's what turns residents into citizens, and its absence, over time, hollows out the democratic relationship from the inside.
That's a good place to land. The absence of geographic representation isn't just a technical flaw in institutional design. It's a quiet erosion of what it means to be a citizen. And now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the 1970s, a reddish-purple food dye was briefly produced on Sakhalin Island from the fermented eggs of a local sea urchin species. The pigment, called echinochrome, turned out to be chemically unstable in canned goods and was abandoned after about 3 years.
Fermented sea urchin eggs. Of course there are.
Abandoned after 3 years. The shelf life of bad ideas.
This has been my weird prompt. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Frumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you listen. Find more episodes at My Weird Prompts.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.